So we finished education.
Good morning. This is the Education Subcommittee of Ways and Means. And it is Monday, March the 13th. And I'd like to open a public hearing on Senate Bills 5516 and Senate Bill 5517. Mr. Wilson.
The death march continues. Nothing against the department, but it is getting long. Keep in mind that on there are responses to questions interspersed throughout the days on the list, mainly trying to link the days of questions were asked. They were placed there generally. It's not always the case, but as much so. Some of the quite a few responses there and quite a few pieces of information in terms of data and stuff like small schools that folks had asked for. So those are interspersed in the days.
Thank you.
I think we're starting on slide 206 today.
Dr. Knorr. What? Oh, okay. Go ahead.
Good morning, Co-Chairs Monroe and Smith Warner, members of the committee. For the record, Salam Noor, Deputy Superintendent of Public Instruction, Oregon Department of Education. And we are pleased to be before you. I wouldn't refer to it as Mr. Wilson has, but we're trying to make it interesting for the committee. But we are really pleased to be in front of you again today to continue our presentation on our agency budget. We started a discussion around grant and aid programs. We will continue that presentation today with a combination of both state and federal programs that are designed specifically to close achievement and opportunity gaps for our historically underserved students. So I think from the various presentations that we have done, including the joint presentation with the Chief Ed Office, I think it's clearly evident that our communities are changing in the state of Oregon. That means more diverse students are attending our schools and are in our classrooms. And as we discussed, that requires a different response on our part as educators and education system. The state invested in some key initiatives aimed specifically at improving outcomes for specific groups of students, such as our African American, Black students, Native students, and English learners. Those investments at the state level are coupled with federal investments that are part of the federal Every Student Succeeds Act, and we'll have an opportunity to go over those in more details with you. I'm going to start our discussion with the African American, Black Student Success plan. However, before I do that, I wanted to show you the investments, which is a combination of state and federal funds. The total funds on is about slightly above $393 million. $5.1 million of those are general funds. $15.7 million are other funds that initially begin as general funds because they're a carve-out from the state school fund, get converted to other funds, and they're part of the investment, and about $372 million are federal funds. The federal funds are designed specifically to supplement the state investment, and they are very targeted resources to support our historically underserved students in both academic and non-academic services for in-school and after-school programs. So that is the current service level allocation. On our first investment, which is the African American Black Student Success Plan, you've heard us talk about this previously. It is an investment enacted by House Bill 2016 in the 2015 session, and directs the Department of Education to develop and implement a statewide education plan for African American Black students from early childhood through post-secondary education. We convene a group of stakeholder and advisory committee of 32 members representing both communities and the education continuum. The grant, this investment led to the awarding of four grants. Three of them went to community-based organizations that focus specifically on serving the needs of African American Black students, including immigrants and newcomers to the United States and their families, in partnership with school districts. And then we have a fourth one that went to an ESD that's serving the same population. We intend to continue that investment based on this current service level request that was included in the governor's budget, should that be appropriated, and to continue to expand that work and bring new sites on board to serve students statewide. The concentration of those grants have been primarily in the Portland metro area, and we intend to spread that out as much as we possibly can and be mindful of our African-American Black student populations throughout the state. The next item is our tribal attendance project, and this was also an appropriation that was made in the 15 session that targets specifically improving outcomes for our Native American students in the area of attendance. We know that chronic absenteeism is a significant challenge in our state, and this program invests in pilot projects that includes partnerships between the school districts and the 9 confederated tribes in the state. And the resources, which are approximately about $150,000 per project, go to hire community advocates that work directly with the students, their families, and the school to improve attendance. In the short time of implementation, we've seen significant spikes in attendance on the part of students at all levels of the education continuum. And we are very excited about this work. It's generating a lot of commitment on the part of parents and engagement in their children's schooling and education, but it's also generating a great understanding within the community about the importance of being in school and the importance of being present, engaged, and actively involved in education for all family members and students.
Madam Co-Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Salam. Nice to see you again today.
Thank you.
I was just wondering, it sounds like there's probably some follow-up information that from the pilot that kind of, I don't want to say results, but kind of a tracking of what's going on. Can you submit that to the committee, whatever kind of follow-up information those pilot projects have been sending back to the OD?
Madam Co-Chair, Mr. Co-Chair, absolutely. The data that's been collected is very preliminary. And it's anecdotal, but we will be more than happy to share that with you. There is an evaluation component that will actually formalize the collection and the report, and we will be more than happy to provide that to you as well.
Thank you.
Senator Roblin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would agree. I would love to see the same on the previous one, since that one ended up mostly being in the metro area, and that was a problem last year that I had with that, the way the grant was done. But it would be good to see what's happening and what information is coming out of those works with African-American students.
Yep.
As well.
Mr. Co-Chair, Madam Co-Chair, Senator Roblin, we would be delighted to provide you that. The only caveat is that these projects are in the early stages
yes.
of development and implementation. The African American Black Student Success Plan has been in implementation since April, and that was stipulated by the bill that the resources would actually be released in April. But we do have great information about what the sites intend to do and the number of students that are being served and the focus of each one of those projects, and we would be happy to provide that.
Yeah.
All right, the next program is our EL state plan, and this is also a state investment of $10.4 million. It's actually more than that, but a portion of that is being held in operations to support various aspects of this program. But the EL plan, this has been a tremendous investment that's potentially impacting over 42,000 students and 91 school districts. The purpose of those funds is to really focus on identifying and replicating and scaling up best practices relative to EL students. When we look at the achievement of our EL students, including graduation, we see that there is achievement gaps there. So the bill was really intended to address those achievement gaps that pertain to our English learners in the state of Oregon and to ensure that they are provided services and through building systems at the school and the district level to sustain those practices. So we've seen districts invest in hiring specialized staff to work specifically with English learners. We've seen them hire coaches to work with teachers that deliver instruction to English learners. The investments are also leading to specific professional development that improves the practice of teachers relative to English learners. Some districts are considering revisions to their curriculum and instruction, the materials that they use to deliver instruction and the methodology for delivering instruction. So districts have been given some resources to really think deeply about the way they've provided services in the past. I've had conversations with superintendent that said to me, I want to change the way we've done things. What we have done obviously is not effective, so we would like to use those resources to rethink curriculum, to rethink instruction, to retrain our staff, to develop a district-wide plan instead of actually handling this as an intervention with a few students. And they believe that will improve instruction actually district-wide. So we have about
Senator Roblin.
Yes, excuse me.
Well, on this one, you gave us some information, or someone did, last week with regard to the fact that those students who have come out of the program are graduating at higher rates than the general white population.
Right.
So
yeah.
They aren't included in, when we say we're not being successful, they aren't included. The only ones that are included are the ones that still haven't gotten out of the program.
Right.
So how do we really have a good evaluation of how we're doing? How many kids are out? How many kids are in?
Mm-hmm.
If the kids that are out are a bigger number than the kids that are in, then it looks like some of our programs are being very successful because the kids are doing better. So I would just like to make sure that we evaluate it well, because some of the conversation that happened in that one was the ones we're having the most difficulty with are the kids that came who didn't have English skills in the high school or later years, not the kids that had come into the program earlier. So I would hope that we don't change the programs that are actually working because we have this impression that it's not working. And I that's a hard one to keep doing, but if we know we're having success and those kids are being successful, I certainly wouldn't want to throw that out because we have conflicting information that says we're not being successful.
Yeah. So. Co-chairs Monroe and Smith Warners, Senator Roblin, you're absolutely correct, and districts are really in charge of this decision. So our role is to partner with districts, provide resources, be really clear in terms of the expectations and the time frame that's associated with this, the intent of the bill. But it really starts with a diagnostic activity on the part of the district to determine what's working, what's not working. As we looked at all districts across the state, we divided them into four quadrants, and those quadrants essentially told us the following, that some districts have high need and low resources. Well, actually, let me just talk a little bit about two sets of districts, actually. So we have transformation districts and target districts. Transformation districts are the 15 districts that are receiving the most intensive support. And the reason they've been designated transformation district because they have a high need and low outcome. So they don't have a lot of resources that are available to them, and they have low outcomes. So that typically results in the kind of outcomes that we see. And then we have 25 target districts, and those are low need and low outcome. So they don't have a lot of need for investment, but they also are experiencing low outcomes relative to their EL students. So this is the methodology that we use to identify districts that are doing really well and perhaps don't need any more resources, but they need the best practices that are available elsewhere. And we are using this as an opportunity to identify those best practices and share them amongst the districts that are participating. We have a total of 91 districts that are currently participating in this program. The 40, the 15 transformation, 25 target, and we have 51 districts that are being served through ESDs because those districts have less than 20 English learners. So instead of supporting them as individual projects, we felt that we can work with ESDs and build capacity at a regional level to develop systems for them to implement. But most importantly, they're learning from each other. So we do want to recognize, support, and celebrate best practices because we do see some really good outcomes in places around the state and build capacity for districts to adopt and replicate practices from other districts. And Senator Roblin, you're absolutely correct. Students that have exited the program, they tend to perform both in terms of achievement and graduation at a much higher level than the rest of their peers.
Follow up?
So, yeah, following up. My concern is you also have to look at the districts and see which ones are having the most turnover with respect to students. So if I have a lot of students coming in and going out every year, and many of those students happen to be non-English speakers, then what we need to find for those districts is programs that gets things happening really quickly because it's hard for them to compare to the next group and make sure that we're looking at the intact group over time as opposed to just looking at their outcomes in a particular year, because those kids can make a big difference in their graduation rates. And you can identify them as a program that really needs help because they've got high need and high failure, when in fact the people are doing a really great job in the middle of it. And I want that to be said. I mean, from my perspective, it's the thing that we did 20 years ago when we said females are not performing as well as males. So we put all the money into females, and now who's performing the worst? The males. So we've got to be careful about how we invest and what we say is the right thing to do, because it has bigger impacts over the long haul. And so a lot of times we work on budgets that are 2 years, and schools work on 18 years of education. So, I mean, I just want to make sure that we're doing it in a way that makes sense, and the information we're gaining from it is transferable to those similar kinds of districts.
Absolutely. The only thing that I would add is that this bill, this investment, has really given us an opportunity to look at EL programs and services statewide. And currently, EL students are served through the Federal Every Student Succeeds Act. They're served through our English Learners Plan that was developed in 2013. And now we have House Bill 3499. So we're using this as an opportunity to have some coherence relative to the work that we do to support our English learners and the work that we do to help districts build systems and capacity that are beyond just biennial investments to support English learners and the benefits that they can reap from those investments, because good instruction positively affects all students. So the opportunity here is for us to develop a single plan, and that's what we have done. We've consolidated all of those efforts into a single plan that allows us to be really clear about the identification of students, the services that are provided to students, and how and when we actually exit students. So districts now have a single plan that is more cohesive than what we've done in the past.
Representative Wisnik.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Doctor, have all the grants been awarded? What are the timelines for evaluation and result and programs? Did any programs contract out? And are they available for review, the grants applicants that were selected?
Co-Chairs Monroe, Smith Warner, Representative Wisnant, this biennium's allocation has been awarded to the 40 districts and the 51 through the ESDs. We are in the process of reviewing plans that have been submitted to us. These 91 districts will constitute the first cohort, and this is intended to be a four-year cohort, from what I understand, based on the legislation. So the allocation that we received this biennium and the allocation that we will receive for this incoming biennium will continue to support those 91 districts for the next 4 years. Next biennium will identify a new cohort, but we will not be able to fund them until the end of the 4 years. The grants are available. We can provide you a highlight of the things that they are working on. We provided opportunities for them to contract out. We suggested that they engage with providers of programs and services and connected them with those providers. I can't tell you right off the top of my head if anybody has taken advantage of that or not.
Let me follow up, Mr.
Go ahead.
Thank
follow
you.
Up.
I think it was 552. Is that correct? The grants were going to be $5 million this year, then $5 million, and then $2 million, or is it 12? All 12. We're talking about all $12
million. Co-Chairs Monroe, Smith Warner, Representative Wisnant, the actual allocation is $12.5 million. A portion of that it was for staffing, and a portion of it will be for program review and evaluation. And so the actual grant amount is, can't see this here, is $10.4 million, for the biennium.
Last follow-up, Ms. Co-Chair. Thank you, Ms. Co-Chair, for your. You mentioned in your comments, Doctor, that the schools are going to evaluate and look back. This is not an allocation, so we're spending $12.5 million to improve our English language program, and related to that, our dropout, absentee rates, and graduation rate. So what kind of staff are you having within your department and your agency to continue to really put more efforts monitoring this oversight?
Yes.
This is not an allocation. We're spending money for results.
Right. Co-Chairs Monroe, Smith Warner, Representative Wisnant, thank you for the question. And you're absolutely right. We do treat this slightly differently than just a straight allocation, because there is specific accountability associated with it. For schools that don't make any progress within 4 years, the bill directs the Department of Education to play a more active role in terms of how they actually plan and allocate the weights that they receive for English learners. So we're very actively engaged with districts. We have a couple of staff members that work work directly with those districts. They actually went out and visited all 40 districts. They're looking at their plans. They're providing guidance and technical assistance for them. This monitoring will be ongoing because I think everybody understands that this is high stakes,
Thank you.
We have to deliver results. We're clear about the outcomes that we're looking for in terms of English language proficiency, all of the things that you mentioned, the attendance, the engagement, and the exiting of students. So we have crystal clear clarity about the purpose of this program and the actual intentions of this program and the results that we're striving for. Districts have been great partners in this work as well, I would say.
Thank you, Ms. Kocher.
You bet. How long does it take a student who moves to this country without knowing our language? How many years before they reach proficiency and can be taken out of the program and just mainstreamed?
Co-Chairman Rowe, I think a lot of that really depends on the student. The general understanding that it takes about 7 years to really achieve proficiency, and that proficiency is what we often refer to as academic English. So students, we have a lot of students that have actually been born and raised in the United States, and they have a language other than English as their home language. So for some of those students, that might be accelerated. It could be faster. It could be 5 years. But we know that students need more intensive support for language development in order to achieve what we call academic language. And the academic language is what allows them to navigate complex texts and subjects and to be successful. So we tend to think about it as a 5 to 7 year interval, but a lot of it depends on the student and the services and the supports that they receive.
Thank you. Okay, why don't you go ahead?
Okay. Thank you very much. I think I'm going to turn it over to Dawn Huckabee, our Assistant Superintendent for Teaching, Learning, and Assessment, and she will go over the federal programs with you.
Good morning, Co-Chair Monroe, Co-Chair Smith-Warner, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Dawn Huckabee. I'm Assistant Superintendent for the Office of Teaching, Learning, Assessment with the Oregon Department of Education. This slide begins a presentation around our federal funds, and these are funds that are designed to support our students in closing those achievement gaps. It's my understanding that you received our summary of our Every Student Succeeds Act plan, the summary as well as the technical document, and our state board will be reviewing that plan at their March 23rd meeting, and we plan to submit to the U.S. Education Department for their submission of April 3rd. We just today received our new template, so the technical document that you received will look different before we submit. So our staff's reviewing that frantically. In fact, some of them in the back here are doing that as we speak. The first grant that I'd like to share with you is our Title I. It's the largest grant that comes to the state in federal funds around closing the achievement gap. And this is to support our schools that have high numbers of students or high percentage of children who are from low-income families, and it provides supplemental services. And these would be in addition to resources they receive from state funds. Our local education agencies we fund schools, and they are funded based on their rank and the number of students who are served according to poverty levels. One thing to note is that if a school has 75% of poverty level of 75% or greater, they are automatically required to be funded under this program. At a previous session, you asked for what are the implications around ESSA and what we might be hearing from the federal government. We are anticipating a reduction in funding in Title I-A during this biennium, and it could be 15 to 20% reduction. This is in part based on the trend of census poverty numbers that are reducing for Oregon in comparison to the nation, and in anticipation of at least a 5% cut federal Title I funding. It's possible that it may be even more than that, depending on how the federal budget plays out. There are not significant changes to the program with ESSA. One addition that we will have to do is to provide a private school ombudsman, and we've already begun that work in figuring out how to do that and really strengthening our partnerships with our private schools as a requirement of this. The other one is how schools are ensuring that they're they're supplementing and not supplanting. There are some expenditures that are changing that previously were based on the district methods or based on individual expenses. Now we'll be looking at it more holistically at the district level.
Representative Lively.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. So the figures that are used for calculating the poverty, so how current or what are those figures based on? I mean, are they within years, or how far back do we go to calculate the poverty levels?
Co-Chairs Monroe, Smith Warner, Representative Lively. I need to double check, but I believe it's no more than 2 years back.
Thank you.
And it is census data
it's census
that is
data.
Used. Yes. So within Title 1A, there's also separate allocations for our school improvement. And these resources are to identify, through our state accountability system, the schools that are in need of additional support. Under our current Elementary Secondary Education Act flexibility waiver, we received funding for our priority and focus schools through this, as well as there was also a separate grant that was called the School Improvement Grants. And as a result of this, we are with the new ESSA, we can set aside up to 7% of our allocations that we receive at the state level for supporting schools in need. That will change from priority and focus schools to schools that will be called comprehensive and targeted improvement schools. We'll be looking at our accountability measures to identify which schools will meet that. It will be at minimum all Title I schools that are in the bottom 5%, and then any high school that is not graduating one-third or more of their students. So we'll be looking at that. Target improvement schools we will be looking at, and this can be any school in the state, not just those that have Title I, and those targeted schools will be looking at where we are seeing a student group or more than one student group that is not making academic or other gains as identified by our accountability system. Title 1C is migrant education, and we receive these funds to provide grants to our local.
Could you just go back one slide?
Yes.
So the second bullet?
Yes.
So what year do you really mean in that? Continue to participate during the 2015-16 school year. Do you mean 17-18?
Let me see here. Actually, well, what we mean is we were supposed to be able to exit schools at the end of the 2015-16 year. However, with Every Student Succeed Acts, we were required to carry over those schools. We could not exit formally our schools in this current school year.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I'm sorry. I'm into it. So Title 1C is migrant education, and again, this is really focusing on our students who are migratory in nature, and is to help reduce the disruption that results from their frequent moves or interruptions in their education. Our federal funds are distributed based on a statutory formula and uses criteria for both preschool programs, summer school, as well as school year programs. Approximately 20,000 students benefit from these resources, and they're served through 19 programs that are sponsored by 10 school districts and 9 ESDs. We were anticipating an increase in Title 1C funds prior to the budget, but now we're thinking we'll probably see a reduction here. Oregon was scheduled to get a little bit more based on the new ESSA, but we're not sure we're going to get that with what may happen at the federal level. Title III is the English Language Acquisition resource. As Dr. Knorr indicated with the House Bill 3499, the English Learners Plan, these are additional resources that school districts receive to support English learners. They are intended they're distributed through, again, a statutory formula, and it uses the eligibility criteria of students who are in our English learner programs. This is approximately 58,000 students served by Title III through 65 programs that are sponsored by 135 school districts. One thing to note with these particular resources is that many schools receive this through a consortia because their number of English learners is so small that they would not have enough resource coming to them individually. So they are part of consortia, typically operated through ESDs. However, sometimes they're operated through local school districts as well. We're not anticipating under ESSA any cuts to this program. However, again, with the federal budget, there is a possibility around that. Title 4B, the 21st Century Community Learning Centers, is...
Representative Wisnett.
Mr. Chair, thank you very much. Real quick, go back. Do we have any indication from ESSA that there will be any change in the reporting on the English language Title III?
Co-Chair Monroe, Co-Chair Smith-Warner, Representative Wisnett. What the change in the reporting is, previously we've had a separate accountability system for our English learners, and with ESSA, that accountability rolls into the accountability for all students. So we will still have identifying the proficiency level, so there'll be in the accountability model a measure around proficiency, what percent of our students are attaining proficiency, as well as looking at growth. So students who are not quite proficient, are they growing, as mentioned by Dr. Knorr, in that 5 to 7 years to be moving towards being exited?
Follow up, Mr.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Ms. Kocher. So that's what ESS promised us, is less oversight. But then we lose what oversight we were having as far as some programs that were helping our ELL students. And is that the same thing for poverty, too? Is that going to be the same thing? Because we did identify in the federal reporting that some things we're doing. So we're going to have less identification of how the money's being spent, which is good for the school districts, but I'm not sure it's good for our programs. Any comments by either one of you?
Co-Chairs Monroe, Smith-Warner, Representative Wisnett. I think the flexibility that's been afforded to us through ESSA will not affect the accountability. I think we've been clear, and the federal government has been really clear with us from the beginning, that these are targeted funds that are intended to supplement the services that schools, that the state provides for schools and districts and students. Our accountability measures will stay in place in terms of tracking and monitoring those funds and the expenditures of those funds and the desired outcomes that are specified in the federal law, which is both language proficiency and academic proficiency and graduation for those students. So I think we do everything in the spirit of partnership and collaboration, but there is clarity about the purpose of these funds and how they intended to be used. And I think districts are extremely mindful of that, and that's part of the reporting requirement to us. We look at plans, we look at budgets and expenditures, and our engagement is around that as well.
Thank you, Doctor. Thank you.
Okay.
So Title 4B, the 21st Century Community Learning Centers, is a competitive grant that districts may apply to receive. Currently, we are serving 22 awardees in 96 sites, and they are in their fourth year. This particular grant is a five-year cohort, and so we are, again, in the fourth year, so next year will be our fifth year, and then we would be anticipating receiving additional federal funding in the second half of this biennium for a new cohort. These opportunities may fund things for tutorial services for students. They provide summer and extended day activities for students, and it helps them to further meet state and local academic achievement standards in those core areas. The next two...
Mr. Co-Chair.
Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Do we see a conflict in the Oregon Promise here, overlap in that? You know, we got mentoring money coming in here, and we're spending mentoring money out of Oregon Promise. Are we mentoring the same or to the same person or same school? How do we? how is that being monitored as far as using the money?
Co-Chair Monroe, Co-Chair Smith-Warner, Representative Wisnett. These grants typically are at elementary to elementary and middle school, so would be a little bit different than the what we might see in the Oregon Promise, which tends to be at the secondary level.
Okay, I'm sorry. I thought I saw this as community college. This is our real young people.
Yes.
I apologize. Thank you.
The next two grants that are in this section are state investments to help support schools and districts that are in need of additional support because of low outcomes for students. I want to note that these resources are included as part of the carve-out for the Network for Quality Teaching and Learning. And in the school and district turnaround grants, you'll see there's a small investment in the general fund and a larger investment at the other funds. These are provided an opportunity for 22 school districts to be engaged with some partnerships with the Department of Education in looking at outcomes, identifying and looking at how they are monitoring their own routines and their own practices, so to speak, around accountability and identifying how they are best going to serve their students to improve outcomes. Anecdotally, we've already seen some strength in student achievement in mathematics by supporting districts in tracking their mobility and discipline issues differently. There's collaboration between school districts and local ESDs in targeted areas. There's been strengthened ESD engagement in supporting those districts differently, and we're helping supported the development of data dashboards and data analysis in many of these local education agencies. The low-performing schools grant is targeted to assist our chronically underperforming school districts, and these resources, primarily in the 15-17 biennium, were used to support a shortfall that we had in our federal resources to support our priority and focus schools. And so these resources helped allocate. We are anticipating a reduction in those federal funds, and so anticipating that this use of the state resources, in particular around any schools that might be identified as targeted improvement, again, that can be any school in the state, not just Title I schools, that this will be a boon to us to be able to help support those schools and districts in identifying what their needs are, and then how they're going to go about addressing them.
Madam Co-Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Can you just lay out briefly the difference between low performing and turnaround and kind of who the targets are?
Yes. The turnaround, Madam Chair, the turnaround districts really is more around a district. And so we looked at districts that had low performance across all or most of their schools. And so we were really focused there to help with that district system. The low-performing schools are those schools that were identified as focus or priority schools.
Okay. Please. If I may, Madam Co-Chair. So what we tried to do with the district performance grants is really to think about strategies that districts can implement district-wide to help improve the performance of all schools. So school improvement grants tend to focus primarily on the school level interventions and supports and systems. With the district improvement grants, this was really a new approach on our part, and it was really an investment by the legislature to say what systems can be built at the district level to think about improving outcomes for all students, to think about interventions at the district level and the school level, to think about graduation as a district-wide endeavor and not just school-by-school endeavor. So we established a criteria that took into consideration trend data over academic performance of all students, groups of students, achievement, graduation, et cetera. And based on that, we were able to identify, I think we had about a dozen districts, and then we did another process where we, you know, distilled that down to the five or six districts that would benefit from this investment. For us, this is also an opportunity to think about how we as a district, as an agency, support those districts in implementing systems. So we're looking at what we do as an agency in terms of the various programs and touch points that we have with the district, the various interactions we have with them around federal programs, state programs, compliance, support, and it's helping us streamline what we do as we engage with those districts. But I really think the difference here is that we're thinking systemically, we're thinking district-wide, and not just specifically school by school.
Senator Roblin.
Yeah, I just want to make it clear again. What other funds, where do most of the other funds come from when we say other funds in this category?
Co-Chair Monroe, Co-Chair Smith-Warner, Senator Roblin, those other funds are part of the carve-out for the Network for Quality Teaching and Learning.
But where do the other funds come from? Not the carve-out, but where they're not general funds, so they are from?
Right. Co-Chairs Monroe, Smith-Warner, Senator Roblin. So the other funds are federal funds. So we have a significant amount of funding that's designated specifically for priority and focus schools. And priority schools are those that are in the lowest 5% tier of performance. The focus schools are within the 15% tier of lowest performance in the state. So the initial investment is the federal monies. We use the federal resources to support those schools. But in the last biennium, we were short on the amount of money that was needed to support those schools, and the legislature provided some additional resources to go directly to school improvement. The legislature also provided these additional resources for district improvement.
I know some of this is state funds,
mm-hmm.
But it's other funds. It's not general fund.
thank you for the co-chairs, Monroe, Smith, Warner, Senator Roblin. Thank you for the question. So this is the interesting part about this. These funds actually start as general funds, and then they turn into other funds. So if we were to go back to House Bill 3499, the carve-out is $12.5 million of general funds. But once they are removed from the state school fund, they're deposited, so to speak, into another account. And Mr. Wilson can talk about this more in a lot more sophistication. They're deposited into another account for the purpose of this discussion, and they become labeled as other funds.
I just a number of people get confused about that and ask me, where did other funds come from? I thought we had school funds. So I just wanted to have a more clarified for people who may be on the phone and ask these questions, and it's hard for me sometimes to answer them.
Thank you for the clarification. We appreciate it. And I don't know if Mr. Wilson... Did I just want to make sure we're representing that correctly.
The unfortunate thing, Mr. Chair, members, is you end up sort of double counting these kinds of funds in the total funds category.
Yeah, that's something I want everybody to understand or get a better understanding of. Thank you.
Hey, moving forward, the governor's recommended budget, you will note that the three programs that Dr. Knorr spoke about do not have any reductions to them in the governor's budget. The school and district turnaround grants does see a small reduction in order to help balance the budget. Additionally, there's an investment in this category, Policy Package 113 for tribal curriculum. This is a general fund investment of $1.8 million to provide grants for the development of tribal school curriculum that would be then distributed to all school districts, and it would be professional development would also be accompanying this to support schools in the implementation of the curriculum. And with that, we'll move to the next section. This will be the last section of grant and aid. These are our student success grants. These grants are designed to empower our students to create their own paths and have a positive impact in the community. And these are additional supports and tools that help them become ready for future learning and success. What you'll see here are grants that primarily focus on our very youngest children and then all the way up through high school. The current service level for the five grants that will be identified in this this particular section. In this case, the other funds are a combination of various grants across, actually, I'm sorry, the federal funds. I want to indicate where it says other under federal funds. We receive a host of grants that are at the federal level that are one-time or one- or two-year kind of grants that we rolled up into a single number here. The first grant in the student success grant area is our early reading grants. In 2013, the Legislative Assembly authorized funding for these early reading programs and funded these grants in order to provide and help improve children's early literacy skills and increase their school readiness. The Reach Out to Read program and the Start Making a Reader Today programs have been in our base budget since then. The Reach Out to Read program provides opportunities for parents to engage with some primary care physicians and during their well child visits, and they receive support and best practices on how to engage their children in reading. And the SMART program pairs adult volunteers with children on weekly one-on-one reading sessions that's aimed at supporting their efforts to read independently. Collectively, these grants provide approximately 25,000 books to our underserved children ages 0 to 6 during the 2015-17 biennium, and with SMART, we were able to mobilize around 4,000 volunteers.
Yeah, that 100,000 for SMART mostly went to purchase books. Is that correct?
I will need, Co-Chair Monroe, I need to double-check on that. I believe so, but I need to confirm that with our staff.
Remember when they asked me for it, that was the purpose, so hope that's correct. Senator Roblin?
So do we ever gather, thank you, Mr. Chair, do we ever gather information on the match that comes to that? I mean, there are a lot of organizations out there that support SMART. SMART itself raises money to buy books and do all those other kinds of things. Do we ever get an accounting of how much money that brings into those programs? I don't think it's our preview, but I just wondered.
Co-Chair Monroe, Co-Chair Smith-Warner, Senator Roblin, we do not.
Okay, thanks.
So now going to the other side of the spectrum of high school, the next grant is our Supporting Accelerated Learning Grant. And these are particularly to enable our students who are low income to achieve college credit courses while still in high school and to increase their preparation for college. You'll see here that a number of bills over the course of the last 4 years have created funds to support training for teachers, to provide instruction in those accelerated college credit programs, to cover the payment of costs that students have related to these programs, and purchase classroom supplies. There was a large investment in the in this current biennium to maintain and increase funding to offset the cost of our advanced placement and international baccalaureate and other dual credit testing and programs. You'll see our numbers for 15-16. Grants provided, as you can see, over 27,000 AP exams, almost 7,000 of those were to our students of low income. And for international baccalaureate, almost a little over 5,500 exams, with over 1,300 of them given to students low academic, low income students. This is does definitely have one of the most immediate and direct impacts on students and their families. The Regional Promise Grants are to develop and expand consortia of combining ESD school districts and post-secondary institutions to create even more opportunities for our high school students to participate and earn college credits. Each consortium serves at least 10,000 students, or 50% or more of the students grades 5 through 12 in these school districts. And the regional grants include at least one Oregon public post-secondary institution, at least three school districts, and at least one ESD. Five grants that have been awarded, and you see those areas listed here in the impact on students in 15-16, almost 18,000 high school students and 3,800 middle school students participated in college-going culture activities sponsored by these grants, such as career fairs, college success courses, AVID, college visits, and more. The last biennium, the Regional Promise Programs increased participation in accelerated courses in participating schools by 226% in 1 year compared to growth in non-regional promise schools.
Do you have statistical evidence that shows those students who received some kind of college credit in high school and what that did in terms of their likelihood of graduating from college and also their likelihood of graduating from college with less debt?
Co-Chair Monroe, I'm going to take a stab at this one, but we may need to come back to you with that. This program is fairly new, so in order for us to see that attainment of a college degree, I don't believe our students have been in college long enough to be there yet.
Okay. Senator Roblin.
I think there is some information out there on those students before the program that took college credits and how they did in graduation. So you might find that. I think their evidence was pretty clear that students who had taken college classes in high school do perform better than the kids who haven't taken it. So it might be that not necessarily related to this grant, but
anecdotally, I'm sure. I mean, I was teaching dual credit classes 50 years ago.
Right.
And my students, you know, anecdotally, they come back and they're gray-haired now, but they come back and tell me what it meant to them to have advanced classes in the, at the high school level and how their careers blossomed because of that.
We do have some anecdotal data about participation, just even in this short time frame. For example, targeted populations such as our Native American students, prior to Regional Promise, 8% participated in accelerated learning opportunities, while in 2015, 39% of Native American students in a Regional Promise school participated in these courses. These funds also bridge the gap between our K-12 and higher ed through professional learning communities. This grant has funded 924 high school teachers and counselors participating with 147 college faculty, resulting in 98 courses. So a lot of work here around helping our high school make that connections to what post-secondary looks like.
Mr. Wilson?
There's also, I believe, Mr. Chair, members, an evaluation of Eastern Promise that may have some some more in-depth information just based on the length of time that program has been around.
That is correct. So moving to the last grant in this particular section are our physical education grants. These grants were initiated in the 2007-2009 biennium, and they are provided for hiring of PE teachers and also for professional development. These grants are designed to support activities related to meeting the physical education instructional requirements for students in grades kindergarten through grade 8. The funding is a combination of general fund received from the department of our general fund for schools, as well as funds that we received through the Tobacco Master Settlement Fund. In 16-17, we were only able to fund the grants to hire teachers, but those supported 57 schools throughout Oregon. In our 17-19 budget, the Tobacco Master Settlement funds that support this program are going to be reduced, and so the governor's recommended budget backfills part of this reduction with general fund.
Madam Co-Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just briefly, have we seen any correlation between the districts that are concerned about their ability to implement the PE requirements starting next year and those who have gotten these grants? Like, has this worked, like, in those schools and or districts? Are they saying, yes, we're fine and ready to implement the PE requirement, and it's the other ones that are saying that they're not? I realize that's highly anecdotal.
Madam Co-Chair, anecdotal data that we have indicates that part of the, to get this grant, they have to identify how they will sustain sustain this. And so, obviously, they've assured us that they are going to be able to sustain this and then be able to continue. Some of these grants funded a full FTE. Some did a partial FTE. And so, anecdotally, yes, we think they're ready to sustain this, but we'll see once we move forward into this next year whether they're not able to do that.
Follow up.
Go ahead.
And could we get a list of who has received these over the last couple of biennia, please?
Yes. Thank you. Sure. We'll get that for you. This last slide, then, in this section is the governor's recommended budget, and you will see that three of the four programs show a reduction with an elimination of those early reading grants. There is a significant investment in this section. It's Policy Package 114, and with the governor's budget to fund Ballot Measure 98, this is a general investment of $139.4 million related to Measure 98 to support student success in career and technical education, college-level education, opportunities, and dropout prevention. The next two slides are to give a bit of detail about what Measure 98 is. It is, as you are well aware, a 2016 ballot initiative that was approved by the voters. It directs funding to school districts to increase high school graduation rates and to ensure students graduate college and career ready. Measure 98 identifies three specific areas where districts must spend these Measure 98 resources. They are to establish or expand their career technical education programs in their high schools, to establish or expand their college-level educational opportunities for students in high schools, and to establish or expand their dropout prevention strategies.
The Measure 98 full cost has been said to be $300 million, not $139. So the governor's recommended does not fully fund the implementation of 98, but only partially funds the implementation.
Co-Chair Monroe, you are correct that the estimated implementation of the full implementation of Measure 98 would be near $300 million, which is approximated to be $800 per student. The governor's recommended budget, given the shortfall that the state is experiencing, was about nearly $139 million, which would be about $400 per student. So it's at 50% that level, yes.
So I've been telling people to fully implement Measure 98, we need additional revenue.
Co-Chair Monroe, I believe that is correct, yes.
Thank you. Mr. Wilson?
In addition to this $139 million, there's also contemplated in the governor's budget about $15 million of backfill for some of the CTE grants that you heard a couple days or last week of, and a little bit of payment of staff in the operations division. So, you know, it's actually less than 139 in some ways because you're backfilling existing general fund programs in addition to the 139.
Okay.
So eligible school districts, all school districts are eligible as well as public charter schools to receive these funds. These funds must be spent on students in grades 9 through 12, although there is an exception to allow for summer work to occur in that year between 8th grade and 9th grade to help with that dropout prevention work. And participation in these programs is voluntary. And state programs such as Youth Corrections, Long-Term Care and Treatment, and the Oregon School for the Deaf, education service districts and nonprofits or other community organizations are not eligible to receive these funds. By rule, we've defined expand, meaning to increase the course offerings, the course participation, supports for students, activities, or services that are available, and to establish means to create or implement new programs or activities that have not previously been in place.
Senator Roblin.
So I just want to make sure that people understand this, and I'll find out the answer. If we cut the general fund, and therefore districts have to cut back on programs, if they cut back an effective CTE program, can it be money from 98 go to keep that at whole, or does it? They just have to start something new that may not be successful?
Co-Chair Monroe, Co-Chair Smith-Warner, Senator Roblin. There is a supplant concern here, and so there is a provision in the law that the measure that allows for continuing of other grant-funded programs. However, it's my understanding it's not if they were previously funded with state resources.
They would not be eligible.
They would not be eligible.
Right. So if you had a good, successful program that's working in a district that you've been paying out of general fund, and you have to cut it because of the shortfall in general fund, you could not use this money to keep it going. That's how I read it, too. I just wanted to make sure that was the interpretation of the department.
Yeah. Co-chairs Monroe, Smith-Warner, Senator Roblin. Yes, there is a supplant grant clause similar to what we see in federal programs that basically says you use those funds to supplement existing programs, but you can't really backfill programs that have been eliminated. There is flexibility in the other areas, especially in the dropout prevention programs. But on the CTE side, I believe that the supplement supplant does provide some restrictions. We're working with districts to try and afford as much flexibility as we possibly can within the rules that have been adopted, recognizing that if the legislature acts and modifies the law, we would have to rewrite those rules. So.
Representative Lively.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Since the participation in the program is voluntary, and I'm trying to understand then from an outcome basis, if a school district chooses not to participate, so are they being, when we're looking at outcomes on the other end, so is there going to be some different judgment or look at those outcomes versus those that choose to participate? I'm going to come back to what Senator Roblin said about those that are doing well already. There may be a reason why they wouldn't want to and the results would be, but I'm trying to understand the relationship between that and what the expectations are, because my understanding of Measure 98 was we raise the whole vote. So I'm just trying to understand if it's voluntary and districts choose not to, then what's going to be the expectation of those districts later from a standpoint of those outcomes?
Co-Chairs Monroe, Smith-Warner, Representative Lively. I think the outcome that we're all striving for is really the same, which is to improve the academic achievements of all students and to improve graduation rates for all students and to really focus some of our resources and energy on our historically underserved populations and students that have some tremendous achievement and opportunity gaps in our system. That does not change. I think that continues to be our focus, that continues to be our priority, and that's what we will engage with schools and districts around. These are resources that districts can use to shore up existing programs, to expand existing programs, to think about new and different strategies, perhaps relative to dropout prevention, expanding existing strategies. So we would hope that all 197 districts apply and take advantage of the resources that would be made available. If they choose not to, it doesn't change the expectations relative to outcomes, but we believe that through additional resources, there may be some targeted investments that help get us there faster.
Sure, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Okay, key performance measure. All right, Mr. Co-Chair, Madam Co-Chair, members of the committee, our next section of the presentation is our key performance measures, and the three of us will be taking turns presenting those. I'm going to turn it over to Sarah Drinkwater to get us started with the
Good morning, Co-Chairs Monroe, Smith-Warner, members of the committee. For the record, Sarah Drinkwater, Assistant Superintendent, Student Services, Oregon Department of Education. And I return this morning to speak about two key performance measures. The first one was shared with you initially by David Mandel when he was here related to the early learning provision. And KPM number 3 deals with the kindergarten assessment. And he shared with you the outcomes and the targets. And as you saw a few days ago last week, that three of the measures, there were increases, and the last one, D, increase in the approaches to learning score, it stayed the same. However, the Oregon Department of Education proposes to change this key performance measure. And the reason that we are proposing the change is to align with the recently adopted early learning standards and to track progress compared with the baseline. So we want to revise the targets to also reflect moving from a timed to an untimed assessment. So you will see six items below that we are wanting to measure, starting with percentage of students entering kindergarten who can identify 18 uppercase English letters, 15 lowercase English letters, and can identify at least three letter sounds. We're also looking at students, the percentage of students who can respond correctly to 8 math questions. There are two items related to approaching or demonstrating self-regulation and interpersonal skills. At the very bottom of the slide are the proposed targets for 2018 and 2019. 60 to 70% in the first, 1, 2, 3, 4, and then looking at the approaches or demonstrating in self-regulation or interpersonal skills are higher, 85%, 95%, and then 95% and 100%. Performance measure number 4 is titled Early Literacy, and it's looking at the number of students meeting or exceeding statewide academic achievement standards in third grade reading. And the three subgroups are all students, students of color, and special education students. And the graph to the right shows the results for 2015-16 as well, or 2015 and 16, and then the target for 2016. So you can see that the majority of students are exceeding the target. Specifically, 48.5% of all third grade students met or exceeded the statewide achievement standards, and that target was 39%. 29% of students of color and 25.5% of special education students met the reading standard. So for 2017-18, the targets are proposed to be 51% for all students, 30% for students of color, and 29% for special education students. So they would be higher targets than where the students are performing now.
Madam Co-Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for setting standards that are higher. That's, I always feel the need to point out when the 2016 target was lower than the 2015 achievement. So thank you for setting standards that are higher. I did just want to ask, though, that still, I mean, given that in the early learning, and I know it's a very different situation, given those very aspirational targets on the last slide for the entering kindergarten stuff, where we're looking for these kids 95% and 100% in 2 years to have these coming in, these numbers seem very low, particularly, I mean, particularly for the students of color. That seems to be assuming slash accepting a really significant gap between the fact that, first of all, you're only looking for half of all students, but then almost 40% less than that for students of color. So I just wondered if you could talk about that.
Thank you for the question, Madam Co-Chair. If we look at the key performance measures for number three, it's an overall score for all of the children coming in, so it's not disaggregated by subgroup. If you look at the KPM 4, there's an all students, and then there's a subgroup students of color. So it's we don't know at this point with the proposed targets what the subgroups would look like. We would certainly want, aspirationally, for them to come in strong, and we're hoping to see that kind of achievement and increase as students begin kindergarten. In looking at the early literacy and determining the sort of appropriate target for either students of color or special education students, in taking a look at where the baseline was and moving from there, we have certainly exceeded the targets in 2016 and then have increased those appropriately so as we strive for closing the achievement gap with the all students group.
That's the first year on here.
Just brief follow up, and I appreciate that, and I get the number sent. I guess I would just argue that, given that the point is indeed closing the achievement gap, perhaps we could set the KPMs for the students of color as part of it to actually get closer, as opposed to both of them just moving at the same proportional level.
Madam Co-Chair, that would be very appropriate as well. We also should take a look at our ESSA plan and make sure there is alignment there with some of those targets as well. Thank you.
Senator Roblin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The academic performance standards, are they based on our use of the state testing? Is that where the standards come from?
Co-Chair Monroe and Co-Chair Smith-Warner, Senator Roblin, yes, it's based on the Smarter Balanced Assessment scores.
Like we're getting
Have we talked with our professionals in the schools about whether those are appropriate? My concern comes back from a lot of teachers that developmentally appropriate practices were not considered when they divided up the standards from the citing it at the top and then just chopping it into 12 equal parts. Didn't mean that the things that we're expecting kindergarten to, most of our research would indicate they really all aren't not all capable of doing because of their developmental brain development. So do we look at that in setting some of these standards? Because I agree entirely with what our co-chair is saying when it comes to each of those students of color and so on should be up higher so that they'd be closer to the total. But when it comes to whether they're appropriate in the first place, have we done any work on that kind of thing from a developmental appropriate practices standpoint?
If you're, it appears that co-chairs Monroe, Smith-Warner, and Senator Roblin, if you're speaking of the kindergarten assessment and the proposal to take a look and change those KPM measures, it's looking at it very developmentally
small.
Appropriate and aligning with the early learning standards. In terms of smarter balanced assessment, I would have to come back with you with information about how those were put together or how they were exactly taken apart. Was it just divided into 12 years, like you suggested? I don't know the answer to that and would need to come back.
Okay. I'd love to have some information on that.
Representative Parrish.
Thanks. I guess I'm really struggling to wrap my head around that third grade reading is a metric. I mean, I went to schools in Oregon. We did not have kindergarten, let alone all-day kindergarten. We can read by third grade. I guess I'm just trying to wrap my head around how half of our kids don't read by the third grade and they're not literate. We've made significant investments since I've been here. We've added all day kindergarten since I've been here. And to certainly expect that somehow kids of color are somehow, we're gonna treat them as a different population and not have set high expectations for those kids. I guess I'm struggling because I know other states are using third grade reading as a metric, but they've also instituted things like if kids don't move on, I mean, what happens to these kids if they're part of the 52% that don't, you know, can't read, we just shove them on to fourth grade? I mean, other states are actually saying, look, we're not gonna socially promote if you can't read. We're gonna hold families accountable, we're gonna hold schools accountable. I feel like we're missing the boat on an accountability metric that other states are using as they talk about third grade reading, and we're not, and we're then going to move kids who are not literate by third grade and promote them on into higher grades. And I can't wrap my head around the fact by third grade I knew how to read and I was in David Douglas schools. So
One of the best school districts in the state, I might add.
I'll have to dig back. You might have been like my instructor or something. But I guess I'm frustrated. I'll be honest. I am really frustrated. We're putting a lot of money into these programs to get numbers that look like that. When of course, I don't know what our numbers looked like when I was in third grade, but if we weren't reading, we weren't moving on. And somehow, we're just shoving these kids on through into the next grade. And the department, the agency, and the governors keep asking us for more money, but this doesn't show us that those dollars are actually working. I think there's some frustration up here.
Co-chairs Monroe, Smith-Warner, and Representative Parrish, you are correct that third grade is kind of a gateway towards good academic achievement as the student moves on in his or her career, sort of learning to read up to third grade and then reading to learn from then on. And that we do have subgroups of students that are performing lower than that, and it's a concern of all of us. Some of the initiatives or programs that we're focusing on is looking at multi-tiered systems of support, the dyslexia bill, which is also supporting teachers in kindergarten to third grade in identifying students with reading difficulties, whether or not it ends up with a specific diagnosis of dyslexia, but trying to early on identify those students as they come in kindergarten and first grade and monitoring them as they move up into third grade. But you're correct about the gateway kind of grade level. You mentioned about retaining students or not socially promoting them, and as with those kinds of decisions, there's also very specific things that probably need to be taken into consideration given each student and whether that would even be appropriate, but to continue to support them as they move on in their career. I don't know if there's any addition.
Thank you. Senator Roblin.
So I'll follow up a little bit on those comments. I was not proficient in reading at third grade. I probably middle school before I got there. And I'm happy they let me keep going because I did eventually catch up. And dyslexia was my problem. So I do understand that. And I'm proud that Julie was a good reader. Or my kids were, thankfully. Another issue. Have we done, on the SATs and those, we're having a big conversation with regard to whether they are culturally biased tests. Have we had that conversation about our state testing? I look at this number, and it looks like it's saying we believe they are. If we're going to have a lower standard for one than the other, then is there a bias in the test itself? And have we looked at that?
Go ahead.
Mr. Co-Chair, Madam Co-Chair, Senator Roblin, for any state test that gets approved to be used for accountability purposes, ensuring that test is has met all of the criteria for cultural sensitivity and bias is one of the criteria that have to be met. That's part of the peer review process that occurs at the national level. So accommodations, access, all of those things have to be part of that test in order for it to be used for accountability purposes. On the kindergarten assessment specifically, I believe that some of those elements were taken into consideration. I would have to consult some of my colleagues and look back and see how much of that was actually done, but I believe having been a part of the early conversations that was something that was on people's mind greatly. We changed the use of that test. So the kindergarten assessment is not used as a summative assessment. It is actually used in a very formative fashion that provides information to teachers to determine how to support that student. So it provides a lot of information in addition to the other types of assessments that schools do and districts regarding incoming kindergartners. So I just want to clarify that we do not use it as a summative assessment. It is not used for accountability purposes. It's really used as an informative assessment to help teachers have more information about the students and where they are relative to a baseline. I think the challenge with assessments like the Kinder assessment is that you have to establish a baseline somewhere, and since it's a new assessment, it's based on students' performance in the first one, two, perhaps even 3 years. So that's what I will say about this assessment and the state assessments, like even SAT. If we were to use that as our state assessment, they have to demonstrate through this rigorous process that they meet all of the accommodation requirements, all of the access requirements, the cultural sensitivity and considerations as well.
So. Thank you.
And we're getting pretty close to the end of our day, so you might choose, you know, where a good place to cut is and continue tomorrow.
Okay. Mr. Co-Chair, Madam Co-Chair, I think we can get through the key performance measures fairly quickly if you'd like us to.
Okay.
So we can start with the Youth Development Division tomorrow.
That would be
okay,
better.
That's great. So forgive me for going through these fast, but the next item is our key performance number 5, students on track to graduate. And just for your information, I'm sure you're aware that students in the state of Oregon must meet 24 credits in order to graduate from high school. So being on track means that a student has 6 credits by the end of ninth grade. The target for the 2015-17 biennium was that 85% of all ninth graders, all students, would be on track to graduate within 4 years. Students of color had a target of 83%, and special education students had a target of 80%. In the 15-16 school year, 83.5% of all ninth graders were on track to graduate. Students of color were at 77.7% and 68.6% for our special education students. In all cases, we do see growth in all categories. In keeping up with the 40-40-20 goals and vision for the state of Oregon, the target we're proposing for 17-19 will increase to 90% for all students groups. So we're suggesting that we want to make sure that all students groups are on track to graduate. So we will go from these three measures, if you will, to a single measure of 90% for all students. It's an aggressive target. We recognize that, but we also aspire to have ambitious and bold targets. The next key performance measure is high school completion. Excuse me. And I will just note that this high school completion rate is a 5-year cohort. For moving forward, ODE would like to request that this be changed to match our goal of students graduating on time, which is really measured by the 4-year cohort. We will continue to measure and report on the 5-year cohort, but we believe that the 4-year cohort is a more accurate indicator of students graduating on time. Based on the measurement of the 5-year cohort, 76.5% of all students graduated compared to the 80% target. This included 70% of students of color compared to a 72% target. The target for special education was 51%, and we exceeded the mark. Let's see, 51%, and we've exceeded that by 58.4%. In looking forward and establishing targets for the 4-year cohort, for 17-18, we propose 81% for all students graduating within 4 years, 70% of students of color in 4 years, and 61% for special education students in 4 years. For 18-19, that number would grow to 84% for all students, 77% for students of color, and 64% for special education students. To your comment, Madam Co-Chair, about having different targets for different student groups, that's something that troubles me as well. We have a single target for all students, both in terms of academic performance and graduation. That's part of our Every Student Succeeds Act plan that we will submit to the U.S. Department of Education, and we would be happy to discuss that with you to determine if we should have differentiated targets or a single target. But we're following the process that has been established for KPMs in the past, but we would be open to discussing that with you and seeking your guidance and direction there. The next slide is the key performance measure for number 7 for college going. And this is the number of students who attend college within 16 months of graduating. The target for all students is 63% in 15-17 and will rise to 65% in 17-19. I think we're still within that target. There has been a slight change from 15-16, but we are still consistent within the target that was established in 2013. This slide is really, it doesn't depict that appropriately, but it's a small change, but I believe we are on target here, and we propose to change it to
65%. That's quite a scale it's using
yes,
there.
Yes, yes. We were reminded with your
multiple
comment,
scales,
Madam Chair, the other day about a zero, so I apologize for the way that's depicted, but it doesn't tell the story. So,
yeah.
Okay, with that, Dawn?
With that, key performance 8 is percentage of our priority and focus schools that would be deemed to be eligible to exit. Based on our 2016 data, you'll see we're just a little bit below the 75% target. However, in conversations with schools and districts, and we anticipate that at the end of this school year, once we have this year's student assessment data, that we will have over that 75% of our schools that were previously identified as focus and priority schools that would have met the criteria to exit. And then we'll be moving forward with new identification. To just wrap up the last three slides, these are our student achievement results for the past 2 years in English language arts and in mathematics. These are the percentage of students who met or exceeded the outcome, the target for their grade level. This includes all students, grades 3 through 8, and as well as high school. And you'll see that for the most part, from the first year of a Smarter Balanced Assessment to the second year, there were increases in nearly all of the student groups in English language arts. In mathematics, again, same group of students from 1 year to the next. And you'll note that most student groups in this increased from year 1 to year 2. And the last slide of our
And I find no fault with this particular graph. Actually done correctly.
The last slide of this presentation is the science achievement. This, again, is students in grades 5th grade, 8th grade, and 11th grade, so a little bit different. Not every student is assessed in grades 3 through 8. It's 5th grade, 8th grade, and 11th grade only. And you'll see that performance, unfortunately, is flat or has declined from 2014, 2015, 16. We are in the process of moving to a new assessment soon that will assess the next generation science standards. So teachers have been teaching the next generation science standards, yet we've been assessing on the old OAK standards. So there's a little bit of dissonance right there between the assessment and the standards that are being taught currently. With that.
Okay. All right. I think this concludes this portion of our presentation, and I believe tomorrow we're slated to start with the Youth Development Division prior to the public hearings, but I will defer to Mr. Wilson.
That, Mr. Chair, members, that is right, and if there's time tomorrow, we'll move on to the operations portion or the staffing portion.
Okay. Great. All right.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Anything from the committee? We will see you all tomorrow.
Right. Thank you very much.